mothers. What other kind of mothers we got? Mean mothers, nice. For all of you politically correct woke mothers, happy birthing person day. Not. It's good to see you here. Next week, Denise Schick will be with us. Denise has written multiple books. One is When Hope Seems Lost, How to Deal with Transgenderism in the Christian Community, Understanding Gender Confusion, a Faith-Based Perspective. She's written some children's books, great resources. I'm glad God made me a girl. The Boy Who Liked Tea Parties. A lot of other books. I think that you'll really enjoy Denise being with us. Just a tremendous personality. She'll be sharing her testimony, and she'll also be here for you to meet her, and perhaps she'll have some material with her. Also want to tell you that starting in June, and we'll talk more about this, I just want to say this and move on. Starting in June, the youth program and children's program on Wednesday night, we're going to move that to Sunday night, and we'll have more details about that and explain why we're going to do that, but start to think about that. Youth, children, that's now on Wednesday night, will be coming to Sunday night, and we're going to try to put a boost in the Sunday night and take advantage of some of that extra daylight, and so that's a plan. And again, think about that as you go forward. This is Mother's Day. My Bible's upside down. It's Mother's Day. And I won't be here on Father's Day. My wife and I will be in Montana. And so I have a plan. And I believe I'm led to do this. What I'm going to do here on Mother's Day is I'm going to preach my Father's Day sermon. And so that'll do a couple things. First of all, the mothers get to sit back and allow their husbands just to get pummeled this morning. And that's a great Mother's Day gift in and of itself. And if I can send any man home better than he came, happy Mother's Day to you. And so, and you know, if you think about it, men need preaching more than women. 90% of our prisoners are men, and that either means they're committing most of crimes or they're the dumb ones that are getting caught, and maybe it's 50-50, but the men are getting locked up, and so that's what I want to do today. I want to talk to men about how to be better husbands, about how to be better fathers, and to do that, I want to use a text in the Bible in the book of Ruth. Now, there are two men here, and points are very simple. Don't be like the first guy, be like the second guy. God doesn't call us to be like the first guy for husbands, for fathers. He calls us to be like the second guy. So look at Ruth chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. Forgive my voice. My kids have infected me, and it's all up in here, and so we'll go as long as we can. Now, it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the land of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi, and the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Two good Klingon names, by the way. Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. And now they took wives of the women of Moab, and the name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth, and they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and so the women survived her two sons and her husband. So here's a family. There's a husband, Elimelech, Naomi, two sons. They live in Bethlehem, which, by the way, means house of bread. But there's a famine in the house of bread. And so Elimelech says, you know what? I'm called to put food on the table. I'm called to put food in their mouths. And so in order for me to do that well, I'm going to have to move my family from the house of bread, which now is a famine, and I'm going to move them 30 to 50 miles to the nation of Moab. Now, the question is did God want that to happen? Is God against a man moving his family? And the answer is no. God came to a guy named Abraham and said, I want you to move your family 1,000 miles. But it seems to me that in this case, that Elimelech did not hear from the Lord. Because Moab was an evil culture. It was a very sexual culture. The book of Numbers describes the Moabites as a very sensual people. In Deuteronomy chapter 23, the Bible says that no Moabite should enter into the temple of God to the 10th generation. So if there has been a Moabite worshiping in your family for hundreds of years, God says, I really don't want you in the temple. So God had seen the Moabites as a people with significant problems. And so Elimelech picks his family up. He moves them to Las Vegas, so to speak. And again, he does that for a purely financial reason. He said, the money will be better financially. Things are going to go better. He doesn't think about who his support group will be. He doesn't think about where they'll worship. He doesn't think about who his wife's support will be. He doesn't think about who his sons might marry, who they'll meet in Moab. He doesn't think about any of that. He makes a financial decision to leave and to go to Moab. Now, what happens in Moab is that they are essentially out of church for 10 years because there's no synagogue in Moab. Out of church for 10 years, his wife doesn't have supports, and his children essentially are thrown to this pagan culture, and they become very much a part of the land of Moab. And we know that because they marry two Moabite women. They could have walked 30 to 50 miles. It would have been that hard to have gone back to Bethlehem and to find wives among the people who worship their God. But by the time they got married, it didn't matter if they found women who worship their God or not. They became very much a part of the culture. Now, Ruth is one of the women who marry one of the sons of Elimelech, and she turns out to be a great woman. But that doesn't mean that he should have married her, because when he married her, she was worshiping a false god. She was in a pagan land, and the Bible told Israelites not to marry the Moabites. And so it does work out, but it only works out to the degree that David and Bathsheba worked out. It still doesn't mean that they should have started their relationship. But again, this man has made a financial decision. He is saying, I've got to do what's in the best interest of my family financially, but he doesn't have any regard for their spiritual welfare. And that makes him a failure in the eyes of God. The Bible says that men, we aren't just to provide for our families financially, but we are to train our children and raise them up in the fear and admonition of the Lord. That's Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4. You and I are not just called to put food on the table, but we are called to raise our children up to know and to fear and to serve the Lord. Now, you say, well, I'm not a culture warrior. If you're a parent, you are a culture warrior. If you are a father, you are called to fight the culture which would try to claim your children as its own. And that means that you ought to the best of your ability, and I realize technology is making this tough, but to the best of your ability, you and I are called to know who our children are with. We're called to know what's on their phones and on their computers. We are called to be the first line of defense to keep them from falling prey to a pagan culture. We live in a very sexualized culture. The Moabites were very sexualized. You and I live in a very sexualized, evil culture. I was talking to my, well, let me put it this way. I was talking to my wife's brother-in-law on a family vacation. And he's an independent, fundamentalist Baptist preacher, and we disagree on some things. And but I said offhandedly, I said just casually, I said, well, you know, people are doing things today, but they were probably always doing it. And he said, not true. He said, you look at the culture today, and you compare it, you use any statistic that might reflect on depravity or sexual looseness from 50 years ago, and it's much worse today. Look at the number of abortions. Look at the number of pregnancies in an unwed situation. Look at the number of STDs. Even look at the number of divorces if you want. Look at any sign that relationally we're living purer, and every sign points to the fact that this is a far more sexualized, far more perverse culture. And look at our music. Look at our movies. Look at our idols. You and I, again, are called to keep our children, to be the front line of defense. And I don't know how successful we're going to be on by ourselves. We need God to help us. But we are called to be culture warriors for our kids. We are called to teach our children, listen, how to recognize relativism in the classroom. How to recognize, I believe, the doctrines of demons in this wokeness that has taken over our culture. And if that means you have to force feed your children Jordan Peterson videos, force feed your children Jordan Peterson YouTube videos. But we are called to do that. Anybody know who that is? Dear Lord, let's go watch Jordan Peterson. Most brilliant guy in analyzing our culture in the world. He's got 150 million views on YouTube. I just thought one of you would be one of those. But anyway, we are called to train our children. We are called to teach our children values. You know, when I was growing up, and I think it's much worse today, Every reason not to be committed to the house of God was somehow tied to college. Well, we can't be there because our kids got to play 12 sports, and they won't get into college unless they play 12 sports, and they got to be in all the clubs, and they got to make like 4.0, so we can't get out because our kids have to study, they have to play sports, and they got to be in all the clubs. And it's all about getting to college. Teach your kids college isn't the most important thing in life. Being obedient to God is more important than getting into the right college. Being a person who stands up for the truth is more important than the right college. Being a person who's respectful and kind, but being a person who is a hard worker is more important than having the right education. I could name, if I could think about it, 12 to 15 more things that are more important than the college you are at and the job that you want. Teach your children proper values. And create for them the relationships. Get them into the right place where they will marry a believer in Jesus Christ. You say, well, that's not important. No. 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians 6:14 says to not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. Bill, find that. Put it up for them. Somebody doesn't believe me here. 2 Corinthians 6:14. Do not be unequally yoked with non-believers. That's in the book. You say she's hot. So is hell. Do not be unequally yoked with non-believers. And girls, before you let him put a ring on it, know the difference in a churchgoer and a Jesus follower. Guys, before you decide to give her a ring, know the difference in a church girl and a Jesus girl. And listen, those are two different things. Listen, our churches are filled with Elimelechs. They go to church. They're young guys. They're consumed with the thought of their career. They are thinking about leaving a retirement a good retirement. They're not thinking about leaving a good legacy. Find you a man who wants to leave a good legacy. Say, how do you find him? How do you tell the difference in a church boy and a Jesus boy? Well, first of all, you be a church girl. Because 80% of it is you being what you ought to be. If you know your Bible, you can tell pretty quick if that joker doesn't know his Bible. If you're a prayer and you go out to eat and he leads prayer, you know that boy hasn't prayed in a while. If you're the real deal, you will be able to tell the phonies really quick if you're the real deal. 80% of it is just being the right person yourself, so you can tell the wrong person. But secondly, let people speak into your life. Find some people who have spiritual discernment, because listen, when you're dating somebody, you don't see all of them. You're seeing the best part of them. You got to have some spiritual discerning people to tell you, hey, man, that's not the kind of person you want. I remember when I decided that I might be in love with my wife. Now, don't do this 2 months before you're going to get married. Don't say, I wonder if he's the right guy. If you think you might like them long term, start looking at it. And I'd have my father check out Jenny and my mother and then my brother. My brother lived a life of debauchery between the age of 20 and 35. He was a musician. And I said, why don't you check her out? And he hung out with her a little bit and said, she ain't no hooch. You're good. You're fine. You're fine. She ain't like the girls around the stage where I play. But you have people check them out. People with some discernment look into that person. I have a friend who pastors in Ohio, a guy named Tony, and he said, I think I've told you this, but he was dating all the girls in the church, and this is a big church, or trying to date all the girls in the church, and he had the youth group fighting left and right because he was dating girls, dumping this one, going with that one. He made a mess. So he's going out of the church one day, and the pastor grabbed him around the shoulder and said, associate pastor, get over here. We're going to pray the spirit of Mormonism out of this boy. And but from that point on, I don't know if there's some overlap. Essentially, he had sort of, and I don't know if it was a defined agreement, but he said, when I would take a girl to church and I was walking out, the pastor would be standing there and he would do this. He said, I finally walked out one day with my wife, the woman I married. He was dating her at the time, and he said, fine. If you want me to do that for you, I'll be glad to do it for you. But don't go tell her the pastor don't think she's marriage material, because that's going to get me into trouble. But have somebody check into her with spiritual discernment. Have people look into him. Be the person you ought to be yourself, but allow people to speak into your life. Don't let your heart ruin your life. It's probably not your heart anyway. It's probably a little lower than that. Don't let your heart ruin your life. Now, don't be Elimelech. He's a man who's thinking about retirement, but he's not thinking about a legacy. And he goes to Moab for financial reasons so they won't starve. And they all die. They all die. He doesn't have a single grandchild to his name. His family doesn't make it to a second generation because he's not thinking legacy, he's thinking about money. And that's what happens when you're one-sided. You can be a believer. You can be raised in the church. But if all you are the business, the money, the finances, and you want to live to give your kids the best of things, you're going to give them to the devil. You've got to think spiritually. Now, Ruth and Naomi, after this death, Naomi says, I'm going back to Bethlehem. I'm going back to where I was raised. And Naomi says, I'll be with you. Your God will be my God. I'll go with you. And so they head back. Now, when Ruth gets to Bethlehem, she's got a lot of things going against her in regards to marriage. She's a Moabite person. Now, I should say this. The Bible, in the Old Testament, the Bible didn't say you couldn't marry a Moabite who converted, because many of the Jews were really converts from other nations that were grafted in. So that's not going to be a problem legally, so to speak. She's converted to the God of Naomi, so she's coming back. But she's still a foreigner. And that's going to be somewhat of a hindrance among the Israelites. She's still a foreigner. Second of all, she's been married. She's a non-virgin. And in that day and age, that was a lot bigger deal than it would ever be in our day and age. Third, she's broke. She doesn't have any money. She had no resources. And fourth, she's vowed that she's going to take care of Naomi. And Naomi is a bitter old woman. In fact, when she gets back, their friends come out and run out and say, "Naomi." And she says, "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara," which means bitter. "Just call me bitter." And so if you can see Ruth's Christian Mingle profile, there's Ruth and there's this bitter old lady standing in the background, and guys are saying, "You look pretty hot, but what about the old bitter woman in the background? Don't tell me it's a package deal," but it's a package deal. And so there she comes back, and she is going to have to find a way just to put food on the table for Naomi. And in verse 1, chapter 2, verse 1, look at this. It says, "There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. So Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, 'Please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him, in whose sight I may find favor.' And she said to him, 'Go, my daughter.' And then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, 'The Lord be with you.' And they answered him, 'The Lord bless you.' And then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, 'Whose young woman is this?' And so the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, 'It is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab.' And she said, 'Please let me glean and gather after the reapers, after the sheaves.'" The reapers, by the way, would go through the fields and they wouldn't collect everything. And God also commanded that, you know, if you had a square field to reap it in a circle and leave the corners for the poor people. So she's coming in after the reapers to try to get grain that they left behind. And so she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house. And then Boaz said to Ruth, "You will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go to glean in another field, nor go from there, but stay close by my young women. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn." So she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" First point, don't be Elimelech if you're a guy. Second point, do be Boaz if you're a guy. Here's Boaz, and here's Ruth, and we know some things about Boaz. First of all, he's very wealthy, but more than that, he's a hard worker. If you're a woman, find your Boaz. Find a man who is a hard worker. Again, he may not be wealthy, but Boaz is in the fields. He's very wealthy. He doesn't have to be in the fields. He's got a lot of people working for him, but Boaz is in the fields. A godly guy is a hardworking guy. Secondly, a godly guy, the guy that you want as your baby daddy, Ruth had as her baby daddy, is a man who is Christian in his character wherever he's at. It's amazing there in verse 4, it says that when Boaz comes into the field, he says, "May the Lord be with you." And they pop up and say, "And may the Lord be with you." Imagine your boss coming through your office saying, "May the Lord be with you." And everybody pops out of their cubicle saying, "And may the Lord be with you." That's sort of what's going on here. And that's a tremendous thing that this man is a believer, but even among his employees, where you would think that he needs to have a little bit of a harder edge to keep everybody in control, he says, "May the Lord be with you. I care about whether the Lord is with you. May the Lord bless you. May the Lord be with you." And they return that out of respect. So not only is he a hardworking man, not only is he genuine in his faith, even in the workplace, but third, he cares about Ruth both financially and spiritually. He cares about her. Because it says that when he sees her, he says, "My daughter, you're my daughter." Now, that could be because he's older than her, but it's interesting to me that he doesn't see her as a Moabite. He doesn't see her as a non-virgin. He doesn't see her as a poor person. But he essentially looks at her and says, "I think you're a daughter of the king. You're a daughter of God. And because you're a daughter of God, I'm going to treat you as my daughter. I'm going to see you as God sees you, and I'm going to treat you as God treats you. You're going to be a daughter to me. I'm going to take care of you." And out of that, notice three things. He provides for her financially. He says, "Get whatever you need out of the field. Take whatever you need. No strings attached. I'm not asking for anything." And by the way, Ruth's in a very vulnerable place. She is a prime person to be taken advantage of in her situation. But he says, "Do whatever you need to do." And then second of all, he says, "And I'm going to keep you safe. I've told the young men not to lay a hand on you." Now, there's two aspects to that. And the first is probably for her safety. Because who knows what happens out there. And if she did something they might not want, they might have just clocked her. But he says, "Listen, I've told the guys not to lay a hand on you, not to touch you. And I'm strong enough to make it stick." And third, he says, "So I care about you financially. I care about your safety. And I care about your character. Because again, the guys are going to leave you alone. You're not going to get hit on in this field. The guys are going to stay away from you. You're not going to have any temptation from these guys because I care about your character. You look like you want to live right. You look like you are a person of strong moral fiber. And I'm going to make sure that that is easy for you to maintain in my field." And so he cares for her. Here's Boaz again, financially working, financially successful, but he's hardworking. He's a person who loves God. And the people who work with him know that he loves God. That's a big difference. People who work with him know he loves, not the people who go to church with him, but the people who work around him every day know he loves God. And third, when he looks at her, he says, "I will care for you financially. I will care for your safety. And I will care for you and your character. That's what, and I'm not asking anything from you, but I'm going to treat you as a daughter of God as long as you're in my field." Now listen, some of you ladies have been in some tough relationships, and it's because you haven't married a safe person. Maybe you're a teenager and you wanted the guy who was exciting and charismatic, and you can be safe and exciting and charismatic. You can be Boaz on a motorcycle. But you didn't marry Boaz on a motorcycle. You got into a relationship with a person who had hurts, habits, and hang-ups that he hadn't worked with, and hurt people. You got into a relationship with a guy like that. You got into a relationship with a guy who did not have control over his self. He didn't have control over his sexual desire, and that should have clued you in. He probably didn't have control over his anger either. He didn't have control over his mind. He'd go from job to job. He didn't have control. And that was all through his life. He wasn't a safe person. There are people who are under the influence of the devil in this world you need to be aware of. And the reason you have the scars is because you did not find a safe person. You didn't find a Boaz. And this is a word for somebody here today who's watching me. The more vulnerable you are as a woman, the less financial security you have. If you are a single mother with children, you are a vulnerable woman whether you feel like you are or not. You need to marry a safe man. You need to find your Boaz. You need to find a man who works hard, who loves Jesus, and who cares about you and will care about you financially, who will care about your children, who will create an atmosphere to protect them, who will care whether you serve the Lord or not, and you won't have to drag out of bed on Sunday morning, but he'll be up, he'll be ready, he will lead his family. He cares about their spirituality. You need a safe man. And let me say this, when you find that man, be his Ruth. Be his Ruth. I like how Ruth comes over there and she bows down. Like, oh, Boaz, Boaz. When Sarah found her Abraham, she called him Lord, the Bible said. When you find your Boaz, lose your attitude. Be his Ruth. Say, man, you're the guy for me. If you love me, if you care about me, if you're concerned about me, if you care whether I make it to heaven or not, if you care whether I can stay home and raise my babies or not, if you care about my safety, if you're concerned about me, I'm going to do everything I can to be the wife that a Boaz ought to have. Got to do that. Wasn't a lot of amen in there, but I'm preaching better than you're giving me credit for. That's good truth. That'll change your life. So listen, point one, don't be Elimelech. Point two, if you're a man, be Boaz. And if you're a woman, find your Boaz. Don't settle for your Elimelech. Now, this is it, and I'm finished. I'm 2 minutes away, or maybe three. You say, well, I can't find a Boaz. I can't find him. I just want to remind you that there was a Boaz who's already died for you on the cross. Boaz came from the tribe of Judah. He was born in Bethlehem. Ruth will later say, he was my redeemer. But there was a guy born of the tribe of Judah, born in Bethlehem, who came to redeem the world. And he was like Boaz. When he saw Ruth, he didn't see her past. He didn't see all the stuff in her background. There are many reasons to look at Ruth and say, well, she's not worthy to be married to a wealthy, successful man like me. She doesn't have anything to offer me. Boaz could have done that, but that wasn't in Boaz's heart, and that wasn't in Jesus's heart. When Jesus came, he saw us, but the Bible said, while we were yet sinners, he died for us. He saw all the mess. He saw the hurts. He saw the mess ups. He saw, and he knew that we weren't worthy of his blood. But he shed it anyway. He died to redeem you and I. And he's here today. And listen, if you never find your Boaz in life, any Boaz you find is a small shadow, a small comparison to the one true Boaz, Jesus Christ. If you got him, you can live without the other Boaz. You can live without him. Stand with me.